This is Kim Sawyer conducting an oral history interview with Frank Gutierrez in the Special Collections Library on January 24, 2001 at 1:25 in the afternoon. This interview is part of the Lubbock Area Vietnam Veterans Oral History Project. Mr. Gutierrez, could you tell me a little bit about your early life? When and where were you born?
I was born here in Lubbock, and except for my military service, I've been in Lubbock all of my life. Went to Lubbock schools, of course. Graduated from Lubbock High School in 1967. And, of course, that was the war was going on already when I was 17. And some friends of mine decided that they were going to volunteer for military service, so I didn't want to be left out, so I persuaded my father to sign for me, so I volunteered for the Army when I was 17, and immediately after graduation we were off to boot camp, to basic training in Fort Polk, Louisiana. So basically speaking, from the time from graduation on, I wasn't around here, and so my 19th birthday, I had just turned 19, and that's when I was assigned to go to Vietnam. So I spent all of 1968 in Vietnam, and came home Christmas Eve of 1968, and finished out the balance of my military obligation at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. And they tried to get me to re-enlist, but there was no way.
So you volunteered before you graduated for high school?
Yes. They had what was called delayed enlistment. And all around me, my cousins, my friends, they were getting drafted. So the volunteering seemed like the reasonable thing to do, because they were gonna get you one way or the other. So, and being that my friends were also volunteering, so it seemed like a good thing to do. Plus, I have an uncle who was my role model. Were it not for him, I probably would not have even thought about joining the military. But he had been in the Army. He came to Texas Tech, and I wanted to follow his lead and be like him. So it wasn't difficult for me to consider joining the Army, because I liked him, mm-hmm. and the way he was, and I wanted to be like him. So it seemed like the logical thing to do at the time. Mm-hmm. I suppose if I had known more about what was going on over there, the reality of the war, I may not have been so eager to volunteer. But I think that I was determined to go there voluntarily or under conscription, one way or the other. I think that I would have wound up there. That was just my mentality at the time, as best as I can recollect. I wasn't scared of the potential of going to Vietnam. It's just that it was something that I felt like I had to do.
How closely had you followed events that were happening there while you were in high school?
Well, being in high school, not very much, except for what I managed to catch on the evening news. Mm-hmm. And because some of my cousins were over there at the time in about 65, 66, that's the only reason that I knew that there was a war going on. But as far as having an in-depth awareness of the war, I was very naive, mm-hmm. let's put it that way.
What was your family's reaction when you told them your plans on enlisting?
My father did not want to sign for me, but eventually he did. And as parents, I know that they didn't want me to go because the war was going on, but I was thinking more about myself than what they were thinking, so it didn't bother me at all that they were opposed to my volunteering for the service. Now, I wasn't volunteering for Vietnam.
Yeah.
I was volunteering for a military service. So they didn't like it.
What made you choose the Army? Was that?
Because of my uncle. Never considered any other branch, as far as I remember. Maybe if my friends would have decided to join the Marine Corps, I may have joined the Marine Corps, but it was more of the peer pressure was what guided me to the most part as to where to go. Plus, at that time, the schools were allowing recruiters to go in and make presentations to students, so that it was as a result of a presentation by a recruiter that we talked about it, and then the other guys, I think the other guys were a year older, so that they were, they didn't have to have their parents' permission, so that they were going to go. They volunteered, and I wanted to go. I wanted to be with them, mm-hmm. part of their group. So that was a reason that I felt like I wanted to go.
Do you recall any of the presentations that these recruiters gave? What the content, or what kinds of things they said to students?
Probably recruiter jargon in order to get people interested. Like I said, I was very naive, and as far as what they were saying to persuade us to volunteer, I don't remember, because it was mainly the peer pressure that was compelling me to volunteer. So whatever they said, it worked for me.
Did they mention Vietnam at all?
Well, no. Okay. They didn't mention it. As far as I remember, they didn't mention it. And if they would have mentioned it, I don't think they would have discouraged me from wanting to consider volunteering. So, but they were very, what I liked was their appearance. They were in Class A uniform. They were very professional in their presentations, and I liked that. So, and that had a lot to do with it. On the contrary, I suppose that if there had been a veteran that had come in and said, "Don't join. There's no direction to the war. There's guys getting killed every day in different ways," I may have thought about it differently. If I'd had a veteran that would have said, "They're spraying a herbicide over there that's going to affect you in years to come," maybe I would have thought about it. But mm-hmm. nobody was. Was saying anything mm-hmm. against the war yeah. at that time. So I'm sure they were there, because I knew some of the guys that had been in Vietnam in the early 60s, all and up until 1967 when I volunteered. So, and they were coming back. But I suppose that because everybody was being criticized, or what was that word I used? Ostracized. By the general public, that they withdrew, and they weren't saying anything, and they should have, because I think that they would have convinced some of us not to go. And I know you understand that within the Latino culture, there's a certain machismo that you have to have. You have to be a part of the military service. And it's part of being a Latino, a Mexican American, and you have this macho attitude about weapons, about being in a war situation. And it was already part of my attitude to be like that. So it wasn't difficult at all to get in there and do what I was supposed to do.
So after graduation, did you immediately went to your basic training, or did you have a little time?
Things changed. In my senior year, I flunked government. And so my commitment to the Army was that to go into basic training right after graduation. So since I didn't graduate, I had to stay behind and complete the course, and immediately after I finished the summer school course, I was on my way to Fort Polk, Louisiana. So my friends were already a month and a half ahead of me, and they were going through basic training in Fort Bliss, Texas, in El Paso. And I went to Fort Polk, so we lost track of each other there for a while. Mm-hmm.
Could you tell me a little bit about your basic training?
It was rigorous. And I enjoyed it because it was everything that I expected in the being yelled at, being cussed at, mm-hmm. the physical activity, the training, learning how to march, learning how to salute, the military code, the uniform corps, military justice. They taught us all that, so I enjoyed that. And thinking about it, I think it was the discipline that I enjoyed because everybody was on the same page. The instructors were very professional. They were all Vietnam veterans, and so they knew what was going on. As a matter of fact, in my basic training, there was a man by the name of Howard Scoville, and he was my drill sergeant, and he was very, very professional, and they would tell us, this is the way you're going to kill Charlie, this is the way you're going to do things in Vietnam, and this is what Charlie's going to try and do to you, so you need to be aware of this. Well, Sergeant Scoville was so dedicated and so gung-ho, he went back to Nam, and he got killed in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So his name is on the wall. And years later, I researched my yearbook from basic training. Out of the 200 or so guys that I trained with, I think it was 25% of them got killed. So, and his name was also on there. So he believed in it, and he went back. He died over there. Howard Scoville. If you have a chance, if you ever have a chance of scrolling through the names on the wall, he's on there.
Could you describe your typical day in basic training?
Up at 4 o'clock in the morning, do the four S's. You familiar with that?
No.
Shave, shower, and shine.
Gotcha.
Right, and then it was either physical training, running, and then breakfast, or vice versa. I don't remember exactly, but we run and do physical training, and then classes during the day, and then more physical training, and then as we got into the different levels of training, and then onto the weapons training and things like that. So it was constant. It was there was not a dull moment. Basically speaking, the training was professional. The food was plentiful and nutritious, and the drill instructors were, I suppose that you could say at that time without their mean, but they had a job to do, and that was turn us into soldiers, and they did their best to train us, and I owe a lot to those guys because eventually we wound up using the training that they put us through. So it was rigorous, it was consistent, and it was with everything that we were going to experience in Vietnam, with everything in mind that we were going to have to know in order to survive. That was a main thing.
You mentioned that most of your instructors had experience in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. How much effect did that have on you and your fellow soldiers? Did that make you want to really pay attention to what they were telling
you?
Yes,
because it was coming from guys who had been there, and they knew exactly what was going on. And I think that they wanted us to know these things because they wanted us to survive. And that was the whole point of the training, was to go over there and win the war. Mm-hmm. So they did their best to teach us. They wouldn't share the bloody details. I remember that very clearly. They wouldn't share any bloody details or any kinds of battles. They just would grill us on the physical training and the importance.
importance of following orders and being and the UCMJ uniform code of military justice, they concentrated on that. But as far as actual war stories, I don't remember them saying anything about that. And I can understand not why they didn't want to share, because they might have persuaded us not to go through that.
What were you and your fellow soldiers, what were your thoughts and ideas knowing that you would, that you were headed to Vietnam? Did you know at this point during basic training that that's...
Well, when you're running and you're training and you're doing physical activities, and then a drill sergeant is saying, this is what you're going to do, Charlie, this is the way you're going to kill Charlie, that's, everybody was trained for that. At that time, it's 1967, about 90-95% of the guys that were training were going to go. Mm-hmm. We didn't know. We knew that the possibilities of going was very high, but we didn't know for sure. Mm-hmm. So that all the training was designed for eventually winding up in Vietnam.
Anything else you'd like to add about basic training? Any incidents that stick out in your mind? Any problems with discipline with any of the recruits?
No. No, the guys that I trained with, about 250 of us, we didn't have any discipline problems. We had a few that were stragglers and just or had been drafted and didn't want to be there. But eventually they got in line. They had this thing called recycle, that if you didn't meet the requirements or if you didn't meet the minimum, if you didn't meet the minimum requirements, then they would send you back to start the training again. So with that in mind, very few soldiers were stragglers, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So they got with it. Mm-hmm. And they didn't want to be left behind, because we would make sure that they would know that they were holding up, that they were holding us up. Mm-hmm. So, and I suppose it was all part of the psychological aspects of the training, that as a group, we trained as a group and we go over there as a group, so we had to, it was teamwork.
After basic training, where was your advanced training?
I did advanced training in Fort Gordon, Georgia. Let me see now. Now I did advanced training there in Fort Polk, and then I went to an additional week, month in Fort Gordon, Georgia, and finished that in December of 1967. And received orders to go to Vietnam, and went home for 2 weeks, and with orders to report to Oakland, California. So I went home for a couple of weeks. At Fort Gordon, I remember that in the last days before graduation, everybody got drunk. The whole company got drunk. And MPs came in and threatened us. Officers came in and threatened us with getting recycled. I don't know what triggered it. But I do remember that everybody was having a party, and I think it was because we just gotten orders to go to Vietnam, and at that point we just didn't care about the consequences. And we had this big party, and I remember that the MPs went out, and the staff officers went out, and they yelled at us for a while, and that was it. Everybody went home eventually. They didn't do anything. I suppose that they under the circumstances, that they expected us to do something, because it was a whole, we're talking about 200 guys getting orders at the same time to go to Vietnam. And none of us, we knew that that there was a high probability that we weren't, it wasn't a sure thing. Mm-hmm. So once it sunk in that we were going, I guess that we felt like we needed to party for a little.
little bit, get it out of the system.
What about weapons training? What kinds of things were you
training? Basic training was small arms. I trained with an M14. Got to throw a grenade a couple of times. And basically that was it in basic training, is to learn how to operate, to use the M14. And when I got to Vietnam, and I was there a couple of days, and I was assigned to an infantry unit. And once I got to an infantry unit, the 25th Infantry Division, and I was assigned to a line company. And as soon as I got there, I was issued a brand new M16. So, and right before we went to Nam at Fort Gordon, we got some training on the M16. Right before we graduated, so we did get some training on that. And that was it. That's the rest of the weapons I learned on the job in Vietnam.
You mentioned you had, I think, 2 weeks before you were. You went to Oakland to depart. What was that like before you went, as far as interactions with your family, with your friends?
I don't recall too much of it. I didn't have a girlfriend at that time, and I made a mistake and got engaged, as I remember. So that once that was done, I was not so eager to go to Vietnam because I had found her, and so I wanted to be around her. As a matter of fact, I wound up reporting a few days late to Oakland, California as a result of that. So, but I will say that the letters from her and then the thought of coming home to her just kept me going. So it as far as that's concerned, some good did come out of it. Even though I got dumped after I came back, so that was part of the process. She was, I think she was a year older or 2 years older, so she was more mature. So she may have known what she was doing now.
You mentioned you were a few days late reporting. Mm-hmm. Were there any consequences for that, or was that?
No, sorry. I don't know if you've heard this before, but you may have. The mentality of veterans at that time was, what are they going to do, send you to Vietnam? So that was the worst thing you could do to anybody, so that there was no reluctance to get off track for a while, because you were still going to go, and you knew they were going to go. So, no, there was nothing. Nobody said anything. They just showed up, and that processed, and within 2-3 days, I was on a plane to Vietnam.
Do you recall what month this was?
It was January.
January
of 68.
January of 68. Now, were you on a commercial charter?
Yes. Yes. They were flying out of Travis Air Force Base.
How many people were on that flight? Estimate, would you say?
It was a plane full. About 350 guys. Mm-hmm. Oakland was, they called it Oakland Army Terminal. Huge hangars with rows of bunks, and there was thousands of guys that were processing. Some to go to Vietnam, some coming back. Mm-hmm. So it was a 24-hour day operation there in Oakland, and you couldn't go anywhere because of the processing and inoculations and issuing jungle fatigue and equipment. Some training, very minimal training. Mainly it was just to hurry up and wait kind of a situation. I was there, I think it was about 3 days before my name came up for a flight to Benoit in South Vietnam.
You mentioned inoculations. Do you recall what they were?
Malaria
and those types of things.
I remember that. Mm-hmm. And brand new jungle fatigues, brand new boots, baseball caps. That was it.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any contact with the people that were returning from Vietnam?
No.
No. Strangely enough, there was a vast difference. It was like night and day. They didn't want to talk to us. Mm-hmm. You didn't want to talk to them because they were different. Mm-hmm. They've aged. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happened to me a year later because we're going over there, pink skin, light skin, and coming back dark or burnt. So mm-hmm. it was a vast difference. Mm-hmm. And I suppose guys coming back, they just wanted to go home. They didn't care for socializing or spending the time with them. The green soldier about what was going on over there, so it was very, as far as I know, there's no interaction with guys coming back.
What was the atmosphere like on the trip over there? Were people nervous? Did you talk about things, what you had expected?
Very quiet. Usually GIs are rowdy when you have 150 guys, very rowdy. But it was very, from what I recall, it was very quiet. There was a commercial flag, stewardesses on board. And when we got to, I think it was either after Hawaii or after the next stop, the stewardesses were not there. They had male stewards because I found out later that because they weren't letting any females into Vietnam because of the danger. So and it was strange. When we noticed that, they said, nice.
They didn't mention it, no. You just noticed.
Just noticed that there was no more stewardesses. Mm-hmm. Still had guys. And that was in the wake of something that woke us up.
So you arrived at Benoit?
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk about your first impressions when you stepped off the plane? What?
I'm sure you heard before stepping off the plane, you feel the heat and the smell. The heat, the activity, trucks, planes, helicopters going back and forth. Benoit was a very safe area, so that there was very little, as far as I recall, very little noise, very little combat noise. And upon arriving in Benoit, we were put on buses, and the buses had screen water on them. And of course, that right away that says, why do they have to have screen water on the windows to keep grenades out in case they were being thrown in? Or to keep guys in from jumping out of the bus. So it worked both ways. But that little by little we started seeing these things. There was a war going on. But Benoit was a relatively safe area.
So where did the buses take?
They took us to a place called the 90th Replacement Battalion there in Benoit. It was the you go in there for processing. More shots, the do's and don'ts of the country, of what to do and not to do. And I remember very vividly the signs that said stay alert, stay alive, all over the place. And these were, the barracks were long, we call them hooches, and they were long, and there was hundreds of guys being processed. And it was located on a hill. Remember this, that the guys coming in country were at the top of the hill. The guys coming home were at the bottom of the hill. So it was a vast contrast because guys at the top of the hill with brand new fatigues and the guys at the bottom of the hill, scuffy, scruffy, long-haired, bearded, tanned, boots that were almost suede-like because they've been there for a year or 2 years. Who knows how long they've been there? But there was quite a difference. And again, they didn't talk to you. And now I know why.
You mentioned they gave you the do's and don'ts. Did they talk? Do you remember what kinds of things they discussed?
I suppose it was military propaganda that we were guests in the country and things like that. That we're supposed to have respect for the people. And that was it, as far as I remember. I know they gave us some handouts of the country. Yes, I remember that about that. This was we are guests in this country, and they have their customs and their traditions. Their culture is different from ours, mm-hmm. So be respectful and mindful of the people in general.
Were you given any specific information about Vietnamese culture or language or anything?
No. I didn't get it. So, just mainly the processing. I was there, I guess, 3 days. And every day, we would have formations of everybody that was there. And trucks would come in, deuce and a halfs would come in, and there would be names called out. And a sergeant would say, the following are going to the 1st Infantry Brigade, the 25th Infantry Division, 1st Cav, 4th Infantry Brigade, 9th Infantry Brigade. So I was trained in field one. So I was under the impression that I was going to go to some rear area. I was there on my third day, they called the formation, and then the following personnel were going to the 25th Infantry Division. And my name came up. That's when I panicked, because I wasn't an infantryman. And I told the sergeants, you know, I'm not infantry, so get your ass on that truck when you're out of here. So there was, once you're there, you're cannon fodder, you have no choice. And so I was assigned to the 25th Infantry Division, and they trucked us, it must have been about 20 guys. And we went through Long Bend, that's the place where the 90th replacement was at. And then we went down Highway 1 through Saigon, and then up towards the Cu Chi base camp. So on that ride, I mean, it was so interesting, so it's a cultural shock because of the way the country is set out, the buildings, the people, motorcycles everywhere, bicycles everywhere, the dress, the women, and got to see a little bit of the French influence on the architecture there. So, but that was only the outskirts of Saigon, and then we went on into Cu Chi base camp. And Cu Chi was, as far as I remember, was a very dusty place. See, now we could see that the activity, helicopters flying overhead, machine gun towers, concertina wire, barbed wire, just a lot of heavy weapons all over the place, tanks at the entrance to the base camp. So that's when I started realizing that there's a war going on. Mm-hmm. And then this was during the day, you could hear artillery going out at that time, and then, it was kind of slow day. So we got assigned to we reported to the brigade headquarters, and then from there we were assigned to the infantry battalion, and I wound up in the headquarters company of the 2nd Battalion, 27th Infantry, And it was, as I got into it, well, while we were there, they said, you're being assigned to the Wolfhounds. That was the name of the unit. And as I, when I got there, I discovered that it was a crack outfit that was heavily into combat, that was had many skirmishes with Viet Cong and North Vietnamese, and had a reputation for being a force to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was some wild times.
And you mentioned you had been trained to be a field lineman.
Yes.
Could you explain what that is exactly and what you're responsible?
Well, there, I had picked that because I felt that it would keep me away from the combat, but I was wrong, because field wireman, we hook up. If a whole battalion or whatever size unit is there, there's always what's called a TOC, a Technical Operations Center, in the center. And from there, you run wires to the different command posts for the different companies. So that was my job.
Communications?
Yes,
okay.
Communications. And of course, I was trained in using the radios and setting up the communications. And whenever the battalion would move, we were one of the first ones in there to set up the communications. And then once we did that, we were regular infantry. So. We had two jobs, and so I was wrong about my training. But when I got there, I enjoyed it, because it was U.S. Army on the move. I was in base camp approximately 2 weeks. During those 2 weeks, I became familiar with the area. We went through what they call jungle school, where they familiarized you with mines, booby traps, and different snakes, insects, and familiarized you with the helicopter and the mode of travel for the battalion. And I think we went through a week of that. Mainly, for those weeks, it was just sit around, sleep, eat. And then one day, the sergeant came in and said, saddle up, and we're going out to the field. So, started handing out grenades, and that's when we realized this is the real thing. When you give 19-year-olds 4 hand grenades and 200 rounds of ammunition, that means you're going somewhere. So it was quite a shock, but at the same time, it was adventure. So they took us out. They had what they call resupply convoys, and in formation, they told us you're going out to the field, and then that meant going out where the rest of the battalion is at. On operations. So they, in the afternoon, early afternoon, we got on a truck that was going out with resupply, ammunition, food, water. And the battalion was located somewhere in the rice paddies. And as we got closer, we could see that there was perimeter and sandbag bunkers around it, and there was a battery of 105-millimeter howitzers, artillery, and there was a helicopter pad. It was during the middle of the day, hot, and we got assigned to where we were at, right in the middle of tactical operations, and got assigned sleeping areas, and of course the ground. So we got settled in, and then it just so happened that there was some patrols out, and then the patrols started coming in, and then the gunfire started. And as soon as it got dark, I mean, there's artillery going out, firing coming back in. We're just there. I mean, I think I was with two other new guys, and we were just terrified because we didn't know what was going on. We just hear the artillery going out and the gunfire coming back in, and then all night long. And then in the morning, the patrols would come back in, and everything was calm. So, and it just so happened that, you see, that was my first day. I think it was the second day that some, what they call Eagle Flights, search and destroy missions, they had gone out on helicopters and were waiting for the helicopters to come back in. And, for some reason, two of them crashed just as they were landing in our area. And it was terrible because there was squads on those helicopters, and as soon as the blades hit, I mean, guys knew what was going to happen, and they started running, dropping whatever they had. They just started dropping it. The ammunition from the machine gun started going off, and whatever ammunition was out there started going off. So we hit the ground, and nobody could move for about 4 or 5 minutes because of all the hot ammunition that was going off. That was my first day. So I got a taste of what was going on the very first day. And then the next day we moved to another area. We did what's called by SLIC, the Huey helicopters. We moved to another area, set up, did the search and destroy missions from there. And little by little I started getting more and more familiar with the day-to-day activities. Mainly during the day, it was just hanging out. There was nothing to do except sleep, stay out of the sun. And if there was a village nearby, I remember we'd often wander off into a village and visit with the Vietnamese or just doing things we were not supposed to do. And during the day, it was quiet. Rarely, my first few months there, rarely did we have any kind of activity. It was at night. Most of the combat was at night. So, and
I can back up just for a minute. Could you describe your living conditions at Coochie, the base?
We lived in I think they were about 20 by 30 inches. Just lumber. Half of it was lumber, and then the other half was screenware, tin roofs. They had maybe 10 cots. That was it. We had lockers, foot lockers. That was it, nothing else. The showers were across the street. They were huge containers for water, and no hot water, of course. It was just a square building where these tanks were on top. You had 4, 5, 6 outlets. And so you'd be walking around in a little towel and, mm-hmm. and some sandals and to take a shower. That was it. As far as showering, we did have showers. And we had a mess hall with hot food. Not the best, but it was hot. And so we got fed. We ate. There was no doubt about the Army feeding us well. We ate. When at base came out of the field, it was different.
How safe did you feel on base?
Well, we got to the point where, and this was going to be Tet of 68. It got very. We had a lot of attacks during the day. At any time, we get mortar attacks where we'd have to run to the bunkers and hope we didn't get hit. So there was a lot of guys that got killed during the day because of the mortars. Because you never knew when they were going to hit. When they were going to hit, and we get a lot of. Probes into the bunker line, Viet Cong would come up and try to get into the wire and get into the wire, mm-hmm. but we were right on top of him, so it wasn't necessary for him to come to the water. We could even just come up through the holes in the tunnel system. So it was that's what made it particularly dangerous, because we never knew when they were going to pop out. So it was, and we often wondered how come things happen in the night and we never saw what was going on. Guys getting their throats cut, so nobody ever knew what was, where these guys could come from. So it was
people on base.
This was yes, happened quite often. So that they were in there, so they knew exactly what we were doing. And we knew that there was a tunnel system, but we didn't know how extensive it was. My understanding is that, and I think it's in that book that you're reading, that the either one of the high-level commanding officers killed some Viet Cong popping up out of the holes, right into the battalion, the division headquarters. Mm-hmm. So they were there, and as a matter of fact, I found out later that the Viet Cong were calling in direct fire into the base camp from inside the base camp. So they were inside the wire, so they knew exactly what was going on. They knew exactly what they hit. They hit them with the first day of the offensive. The ammo dump went up. Tremendous explosion from them. And then remember that we were activated and went out to as a what they called a reactionary force, because Tonson knew Saigon was getting hit, and we were 25 kilometers from Tonson Nut. So that some of our units went into Saigon in the middle of the night, and then a couple of days later my unit went in for cleanup. So I think we stayed there a couple of weeks, and then we went out to some other area. I don't know where. See, that's why I'm very vague on details. I was just part of a huge military force, and I never knew exactly where I was at any one time. And I didn't care, because the main thing was trying to do my part to stay alive and do my job as a communications guy, and then at night be out there on pulling guard and making sure the Viet Cong wouldn't come into our area. So it was quite hairy.
How much did you know about the tunnel system? You said, was that discussed, or was it something that they told you about prior to you getting to Kuching?
Yeah, they pointed that out in the jungle school, that there was a tunnel system, but of course at that time we didn't know how extensive it was. We just knew, we kept hearing it. It goes all the way up to the Cambodian border, and it goes all the way over to Nui Bao Dinh, the Black Virgin Mountain. It's the highest point in that area, and that's all I remember hearing about. But we saw that of course you've heard about tunnel rats, mm-hmm. guys going in the tunnel. So we had numerous tunnel rats, but we never knew exactly where all how extensive, where the entrances were, or the egresses were. We just didn't know. Mm-hmm. I didn't know. I just knew that I didn't want to be near them.
How long would your time out in the field last? You mentioned you started out by going on resupply missions. Was that, did you have a set amount of days you would spend out in the field? Was it consistent?
No. Sometimes we were gone for a few days, sometimes weeks, sometimes months. But most of my time was spent out in the field on operations as part of the battalion search and destroy missions. So it varied from a few days to months before we came back into the base camp. It all depended on how the operations were going, or if we needed, or if the the officer decided that we needed an arrest. To me, it seems like periods of rest were more of a reward or a morale booster, because there's no rest. I mean, hardly ever. You never got a full night's sleep. If you slept, you slept 2 hours at a time out in the field.
Mm-hmm.
2 hours at a time at most, because you're constantly on watch. In base camp, you get to sleep a little bit longer because it's more secure, and because there's constant lookout for mortar fire and patrols going in and out, so that it was a little bit safer in base camp. Although some of us preferred to be out in the field, because it was you were more in control of a little area. I know I like being out in the field as opposed to being at base camp, because base camp was, especially the infantry units, we were always getting hit with mortar fire. So, and I remember that our area was heavily was a target for rockets, for 122 millimeter rockets, and I think they were Russian made rockets that would fire at us. Powerful. It did some net damage to us. I remember they hit an infantry barracks and you guys got killed. So, and that was a reason some of us preferred to be on the field, because of the Viet Cong using the rockets on us. Where they came from, I don't know. I know that the mortars. I know that they would bring the mortar tubes out of the tunnels, and pop off a few rounds, and then they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time we had we got permission to fire them back, they were already gone. So it was chaos. To an extent, it was chaos. We just didn't know. It was frustrating. I remember it was very frustrating because we didn't know where they were at, how many of them. At any given time. That's how come when they, in the Tet Offensive of 1968, when they got, there was over 1,000 Viet Cong that were in one place at one time, they got slaughtered by the three-quarter cav, an armory unit of the 25th Division. They went into Tonson, and they just annihilated them. They were in one place at the time. And see, that was the mentality, that if you had an opportunity to make contact, heavy contact, and you went all out, fire bombers, artillery, I mean, just all out, because it was payback time.
Could you describe some of the, you mentioned that when you were out in the field, most of the activity seemed to take place during the night. Is that correct? What was your typical day like? How would you start the day? Did you receive briefings on what to expect?
I did. We did. I'm sure the sergeants did and people in charge. We never did. I never did. I just followed orders and just do my job. And it was a routine. The routine was the first light, if there's a cook, the cook would fire up a little stove and scramble some eggs, and people would eat scrambled eggs out of a paper plate. So otherwise it was sea rations. And then you just try to sleep, because the day's going to be hot. And then you're going to have to face the night again, so you don't know where they're going to send you, or if you're going to be out on the bunker line or in a bunker, or you just never knew. So you tried to sleep as much as you could during the day. So we'd set up our liners, blankets,
mm-hmm.
camouflage blankets, set up a cover and just try and sleep, because it was precious. Because
mm-hmm.
at night, it was, you didn't want to be asleep. and sometimes you couldn't speak. It got to the point, Cam, that I remember this very clearly. There was always, most of the time we had an artillery battery, four guns, four 105s. They were constantly firing. It got to the point where I could actually sleep during the firing missions. And it didn't bother me. And it, of course, it didn't bother us, but it didn't bother us to have all this constant just boom, boom, just of outgoing fire. And then when it was incoming, of course, that was different. But it got to the point where we were so exhausted, we just sleep during firing missions, and it didn't bother us.
Did they give you earplugs or any kind of protection for all of the...
No, it was... in training, yes, you had the earplugs. Over there, I don't remember anybody having earplugs. I mean, it would just cut loose, and you could just... I mean, it was so exciting that you didn't even think about the noise. The noise was tremendous. Whenever there was ground fire, it was tremendous. And it affected me, without a doubt. It affected me. But as far as something like that, thinking about it, you just cut loose and just bear with the noise. And of course, you'd be numb. The thing to do was keep your mouth open so you wouldn't get your eardrums busted. So that was the key. But it was fun. Thinking about it, it was fun. Being under fire and firing back, it was excitement. Of course, we were scared. But if you weren't scared, it was foolish not to be scared. But all of us were scared. Not cowardly, but just scared. I mean, you didn't know what was out there. Years later, I find out we're in the middle of the North Vietnamese Army, and so that kind of bothers me now, because at that time, when you were new, how close we were to these guys. And that's how come my friend Valentine, he's filled me in on that, and he told me that we were in the middle of the North Vietnamese Army.
Did you ever see it?
I didn't
see the enemy?
So dead. I mainly saw dead Viet Cong. Never. Well, the ones we saw, I remember seeing alive, were always running. But as far as actually, I never did. It was mainly dead ones. Live ones, just when they were, because mainly my involvement was mainly at night. So I never was actually able to see, didn't want to, because it was so much noise and so much firepower that was being expended. And then for example, if they were attacking us, then we'd always count on the gunships, the helicopters, and they would do a job, firing their miniguns and artillery, firing point blank. So whatever wounded there were taken off by, or whatever casualties were inflicted on them, they were. Firepower has a tendency to blow up a human body into a bunch of pieces, so there was nothing. So, and whatever they would always take their, some of the times they would take their dead. A lot of times we just have to go in and clean up the place, mass graves and things like that. So the only live Viet Cong I ever saw were the prisoners of war, what they call the Chu Hoys.
I wanted to ask you, what was the procedure or the protocol for firing? Would you have to call and get permission if you were fired upon, or how would that
out in the base camps? Yes,
or out in the field?
In the field, it was different, because if you saw something, you just cut loose. Mm-hmm. That happened a lot. And again, it was because we were so tense. Mm-hmm. So if you heard something or you saw some movement, you cut loose, call in artillery. Cut loose with grenade launchers, and I mean, just and wait till morning to find out if there was anybody there. But there was a lot. There was a lot of rules and unnecessary rules and regulations. But out in the field, it was very lax. One thing for sure in the field, safety was first and foremost. Because you wanted to make sure that when you're firing, it's not your own guys. We had a lot of that. We had a lot of friendly fire. Guys getting killed by our own guys. And it was just because trying to conduct operations in the dark and trying to get accurate grid coordinates for firing missions in the dark is very difficult. So we're guys killed by our own gunfire.
What kind of precautions were taken to avoid those kinds of things?
Making sure that who's going out on patrol, knowing exactly who's where and what, mm-hmm. when. Single flares, certain color men, you coming in, certain color men, you going out. So those were the extent of the safety precautions. We had some very good squad leaders and officers. They knew what they were doing. I was just an infantry guy, private, first class. I was just a rifleman. But we had the guys that were there longer had been there for a while. They were experienced fighters, and they loved it. And so they would always look out for us because they knew more about. I was there a year, and I was with the infantry for 8 months. So the heavy fighting was being done by the guys that had already been in there for anywhere from 6 months to a year. So we had a lot of good fighters that knew what they were doing, and they would make sure that the rest of us were safe. I'm very grateful for guys like that, because they were fearless, and they were very good at what they were doing, and they inflicted some heavy casualties on the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese. And I know this because over the years I've tried to keep up with what happened. And I've been in contact with guys that I knew then that presently are. There was one guy that were friends there in Vietnam, and I've seen him. Matter of fact, he came to Tech and got his PhD in psychology, and was working with veterans at the VA hospital in Waco. And he was able to fill me in a lot of these things that happened there. And he was a little bit older. He'd been in Vietnam longer. He'd been in combat longer. So when I saw him here, and over the years, he's filled me in on some of the things that happened. It's a haze as to what happened, because it may sound strange, but seeing movies about Vietnam helps to understand more, because you're in one small space, you can't be out looking around, you're not aware of what's going on, so seeing it from a different perspective, you understand what's going on, and in all the noise and all the commotion and all the yelling and the screaming, and you don't know, and you don't want to know. So and like I said, it was by watching these things, even though they're movies, one movie in particular,
give a lot of insight was platoon, because of the reality of that movie and seeing it at that level, it helped. Because I mean, my role was just do my best to do my job, fire back when fired upon. It was just, I didn't know what it was called. All I could see was just the firepower all around me. It was awful.
What was your friend's name? Do you remember that you mentioned who got his PhD and what the heck?
Fernando Garza. He's from Corpus Christi. And he may still be at the VA in Waco, Texas.
You mentioned that you were more focused on what was happening with yourself and with your unit. How aware were you of bigger picture things as far as the politics or...
Didn't care.
Didn't care. Was that standard among...
Yes. No. Yes, because it all keeps coming back to the warnings. So stay alert, stay alive, and that was it. Mm-hmm. That was it. You had to. It's things as simple as falling asleep on guard duty would get people killed. So you had to, because if you wanted to make that, I mean, the veterans, the guys that had been there longer or had more combat experience, that was what they kept stressing. So just stay alert. Stay alert. You'll make it home. Just do what you're told to. Don't take chances. Don't take a risk unless you absolutely just know that you have to. Otherwise, it's you do your best to stay alive.
Out in the field, or even on back at base, did you have any time off, so to speak? What did you do for R&R?
Drink beer. and I mean that because that was an outlet. That was a way of unwinding. In the base camps, I don't know where we were at. We had an enlisted men's club where we would go and listen to rock and roll music on the jukebox and do our best to forget about the war. And there was always plenty of beer. I think beer was 25 cents a can.
Was that American beer?
Yeah. No, it's 15 cents a can in MPC, military purchase currency. And they were always well stocked. On occasion, a band would come in. Occasionally, they would put on a film outside for us to watch. Otherwise, it was... That was it, because it was just, if you had free time, it was asleep. But as far as entertainment, that was it. Hang out, EM club, drink some beers, and listen to rock and roll music, and wish you were home, things like that. That's one thing that stands out in my mind, is the music from that era.
Any bands in particular, or songs that you can think of?
Of course, the Beatles were prominent. That somehow the music fit in with the Vietnam. For example, the Animals have one. It's called "We've Got to Get Out of This Place." Strawberry Fields, Otis Redding sitting on the back of the bay, and things like that just brings a lot of memories about being in Vietnam. James Brown music, of course, the Rolling Stones, Steppenwolf, Born to Be Wild. I mean, that was just, you could just hear it blasting all over the place. And of course, there was the radio station out of Saigon, AFBN. That was very popular, that we all listened to, because it was all rock and roll music. I understand it And you've probably seen or may have heard about the movie Good Morning Vietnam. Mm-hmm. That is true. And I don't know if before they started playing rock and roll, it was classical music, because all this other music, but all we heard was rock and roll, because that's what we wanted mm-hmm. to hear. So every day you could hear radios just blasting.
Did you listen to it out in the field
yes.
as well?
Okay. Yes, we weren't supposed to.
Yeah.
I remember radios being confiscated, especially at night, because obviously you bring attention to yourself or let the enemy know where you're at. Transistor radios were not allowed in the field. But in base camps, you could just hear the stereos blasting all over the place. I mean, it was fun mm-hmm. to listen to all the music coming from all over the place. And of course, the blacks had their own music. But generally speaking, regardless of background, we all listen like rock and roll. Call it the rock and roll war. So that music brings a lot of memories. Listening to it now, like I said, that getting we gotta get out of this place reminds me of the replacement station in Long Bend, when there's 300, 400, 500 guys in one place, all brand new, and we don't know what our destiny is, and then we're listening to this music, and then just the song fits. We gotta get out of this place if it's the last thing we ever do. And there's some other songs that remind me of that. I'll think of the names as we get into it.
What about USO shows? Did you have an opportunity to see any of that?
Let me see. Well, we had, I think they were Filipino bands that came out in our EMPM club one time, twice, and they entertained us for a while. In the bigger base camps, they had better shows.
Mm-hmm.
I remember in Long Bend, when I got there at the EM club, there was a group where this musician was, imitated James Brown to a T. Exactly like James Brown. So that was very exciting. I mean, they had everybody jumping up and down. So they were good. Bob Hope I missed because I had gotten my orders to come home, and he was doing the Christmas show in Long Bend, and that's the place that's where the 90th replacement battalion was at, so that I almost didn't get processed to come home because of the everybody being at the Bob Hope show. And this was right on the 23rd of December.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on my way home, so there was a slowdown of processing, but we got out of there right on the 23rd, and the show was going on. So, but I could only see the crowd. I mean, at that point, I didn't care about it. I just wanted to get out of there.
And you mentioned Long Bend. You were at Coochie, and then you moved
yes.
to Long Bend?
In the summer of 1968, I was with my unit. We were out in the field somewhere. We were in this nasty place. We couldn't fill sandbags because the dirt was just mud, caked
mm-hmm.
mud. And the reason I say it's nasty because it was jungle, and we just moved in, and then over the communication system, my name came up and said, they said the following enlisted men are to report back to Coochie, to Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
And my name came up, and so I got on a helicopter, and I went back to Coochie, and then the next day I reported to battalion headquarters, and they had something like 200 other guys that had come in from different units out of the division. And we got on trucks and we went back to Long Bend to work in an ammunition dump. I think, as best as I've been able to piece it together, that there was a lot of casualties during the offensive of 1968 there in the Emerald, and there had been a lot of guys that got hurt. And so we were replacements to work in the ammunition dump. So it was, I wound up in, what was it called, the 3rd Ordnance Battalion, there in Long Bend. The facilities were a lot better. The work was hard because we had to be loading and stacking and tending to the ammo dumps, high explosives and all that, which I did not mind because in comparison to being out in the boonies, working in an ammo dump was, to me, was all right. When my platoon sergeant found out that I had been in an infantry unit, he assigned me to ride shotgun on convoys back to Coochie and into a place called Tainan. So that I was running ammunition back to Coochie, back to the place I had been. This is where my friend Terry Ballantyne comes into the picture, because when I went through it, I remember the convoy stop there in Coochie. Our destination was Tainan. Tainan was the base camp, had units of 1st Cavalry. And our convoy had to stop in Coochie because there was a firefight on the highway. We couldn't go any further. So I went back into the area that I had been in, the battalion I had been in, and it was deserted. And the guys that were there told me that everybody had been activated because they had had been ambushed, and then 150 guys killed in one whack, and several wounded, so that everybody cooks. Everybody had been mobilized and sent out to the field. And this was in the summer of 68, so that when I visited with them, and then I went back, we made it back to Tainan, we dumped off the ammunition, and we rode the convoy back to Long Bend, and I worked there, and then my platoon was assigned to go to Tainan to work in the ammunition dump. In Tainan, it was about 50 miles from Saigon, right on the Cambodian border, right next to the Black Virgin Dump. So that there was a lot of activity there. It was a smaller base camp, and so we were busy. We were providing ammunition to the cavalry units or all the other infantry units, and then at night we were tending to our own bunker line, and it was a lot of heavy fighting going on at night, and especially at night. And on the mountain, there was a lot of fighting going on. We were right next to it. We used to sit back and watch the war, watch the shooting from the top to the bottom and from the bottom to the top, and fires coming in. It was exciting. And then we had our own bunker line to protect. And we were busy every day. And the gunships were busy every day. So there was some heavy fighting going on. That went on for the balance of my tour. This was September 68. September 1968 is when I wound up in Tainan. And I went there September, October, November, December of 68. I got my orders to come home.
What were your responsibilities? You worked in the ammo dump, you said you were. What kinds of things did you personally do?
My job was to keep track of what was actually in the, call them pads. Mm-hmm. And then towards the end of my tour, I was assigned to blow up stuff so that we collect obsolete ammunition artillery shells, smoke grenades, all kinds of ammunition. We collect that, load it up on trucks, and then take it out into the jungle and unload it, pile it up, and then put C4 charges around, plastic explosive around it, and then blow it up.
Is that standard practice to destroy any?
It's done because we were providing ammunition to the enemy, because not all of it would blow up. But that was SOP for the Army at that time. And plus, the Army didn't want to take chances on an artillery shell blowing up in the tube, or a smoke a grenade, or anything blowing up in somebody's hand. So the best thing to do was just take it and blow it all up. And so I did that for the rest of my time. I worked with what's called an EOD specialist, ordnance something specialist, that was his specialty, handling high explosives. So my job was to be a part of the group that would load up the ammunition, and then we'd take it out into the jungle and stack it very neat. And, I was one of the last, he and I were the last ones. He'd pull the fuse, mm-hmm. and we'd jump into a Jeep and run back into the base camp, and then by the time we were back into the wire, they'd close the gate, and we'd look, turn back, and watch our explosions. Mm. It was huge explosions, colorful, because all the different kinds of smoke grenades and different ammunition that was going off. So that was our job.
Were there any accidents in handling the live ammunition? Mm. Were you really concerned about your personal safety? Did you have specific?
There was no time.
No time.
There was no time. Never thought about it. I mean, mind you, I'd been in the infantry unit, and for me, this was safe, relatively safe, compared to being with the infantry. And guys in the infantry now tell me, well, you were in a war situation, and because if somebody would have, if the Viet Cong, and they did on occasion. Throw in a mortar on an ammunition pad, and the whole thing goes off. But that never happened when I was there, until the very last, my last week, my last night, in this unit, we got hit. So I never knew what happened, but we got hit. And I left the next day. But as far as, to the best of my knowledge, I don't remember of anybody getting seriously hurt. There was some guys hurt when we were all in one place at one time. Of course, the ammunition falling off truck and crushing a civilian. I remember one guy who was trying to change a flat on a big truck, and the pressure ring flew off and blew the guy's head off. So there was things like that. One time they were in a tunnel system, and they ordered a flamethrower, and the colonel was going to test it, and he strapped it on, and somebody was messing with the valve, and the valve came off, and so there was a liquid gasoline spraying all over the place, and it lifted him up, and he came down on his rear end. And fortunately, nobody was smoking around at the time, so there was things like that. As far as somebody getting shot accidentally, not in my unit, because everybody was very careful. In thinking about it, we didn't have accidents, guys shooting somebody else accidentally, or gun going off. It just didn't happen, because we were always very careful about it. I mean, just imagine 18, 19 year olds with heavy weapons and all kinds of different firepower. You had to be extremely careful. You had to know what you had to pay attention to what you were doing, because it was your own life and those of the guys around you. So we were always very careful about what we were doing. Because it was bad enough having to deal with the elements and getting sniped at, which happened very often, that we didn't want to increase the possibility of getting killed by our own mistakes. So we were always very careful.
Was there any incidents of racial tension that you observed?
Oh, yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. There was, the Black Power Movement. In the field, we didn't have racial tension. There's no such thing as racial tension in the field because everybody's armed, everybody's unequal. On equal ground, you have to get along, because if you don't, one of your own guys may blow you away. In the base camps, that's what I remember, not in the infantry, and not in Coochie, at the 25th Infantry Division, but what I saw it over in Long Bend it was a huge military depot. That's where I saw it more, because there was more blacks. There was more soldiers, mm-hmm. more support units. Mm-hmm. And you may have come across this before. At the height of the war in 1968, there was 500,000 troops, but only 55,000 were actually in combat. So everybody else was in their areas. The racial tension that I saw, well, I didn't experience it personally, because being a Mexican background, I fit in with the whites and with the blacks, so I never was exposed to any kind of, I knew that it was there, mm-hmm. I knew that the blacks were very hostile, especially when Martin Luther King was assassinated, April of 68, it was especially hostile, and then there was a as far as them actually doing something, we just, we knew it was there because it was so, the potential for riots was there. The stockade was full of they called it LBJ, Long Bend Jail. It was full of guys that were there because of drugs, mm-hmm. killing somebody, killing a civilian. I heard, but I haven't come across anything about it, but I heard that there was a riot there in 1968 where the guards actually turned the machine guns on all guys. So mm-hmm. that's true, but I've never heard anything else of it. Mm-hmm. I remember that there was some talk about that in 1968 at the stockade. The stockade was very dangerous because of the dope dealers and all the different people that. They just didn't want any part of the war and preferred to be in prison than to be fighting. So, I don't. Have you run across anything?
I've not, but that's something to be looked into. That's interesting.
Yeah, because it did happen, and the racial tension was there, but it was not in the field, to the best of my knowledge and my experience. Not out in the combat areas. It just didn't exist because there was no. It just didn't exist. You could be right next to the black guys and the white guys, and everybody was your friend, everybody was your brother. You had to be, because you got to deal with the enemy, and now you have to deal with your own buddies. So with the base camps, they were, I remember there being some hostile situations, mm-hmm. but nothing that you could say that was a riot, not during the time that I was there.
You mentioned drugs. How prevalent was that? You hear stories as far as...
I think that's been taken out of context, mm-hmm. because sure, there was pot in the field, but as far as heroin, cocaine, I never saw any. I only heard about it. And I knew that a lot of the guys that were in Long Bend penitentiary was because of drugs, And as far as that stereotype of drug crazed Vietnam veterans, it's a stereotype. I didn't see any of it. I know that there was a lot of marijuana around. That was a more of an outlet, more of a recreational thing. As far as the other stuff, I don't know if it existed. It doesn't mean it didn't exist. But as far as it being a problem, I don't think so, because I didn't see it. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was available in bigger base camps or in the rear areas, but it was happening. I know guys were sending marijuana back in their personal belongings. For example, I remember one guy filled up a lot of those film canisters, sent them home, carried them with me. I just wanted to get out of there. I never messed with it. I just didn't care for it, because it was bad enough being there and then to complicate it with something like that. I was not interested.
Mm-hmm. How often did you correspond with friends and family back home?
Weekly. I tried to write as much as I could. I didn't write as much as I wanted to, but I got plenty of mail. That kept me going. My girlfriend wrote 2-3 times a week. My parents wrote at least twice a week. So, and different people mm-hmm. would write. I would write as often as I could, which was maybe at least once a week. It wasn't a priority. I didn't want to worry my parents. See, that was the thing. I didn't want to worry them. And because I knew that they were seeing a lot of things on TV. And we sure were in some bad situations, but I didn't want to compound their stress by me telling them about what was going on. So I tried not to share or say anything. Mm-hmm. I was just the usual thing. I'm okay. Everything's right. How's the family? Mm-hmm. And that was it. Nothing about so-and-so got killed or were ambushed or nothing of the sort. It wasn't. I was to the point that on my information I indicate, and when it said, do you want your family notified in case you're wounded? I said, no, I'm wounded. I mean, why should you? If I'm killed, obviously they're going to find out, but not if you're wounded. Why complicate it? Because I knew that they were worried about me, and I just didn't want them to be even more concerned about what was going on. Not that they didn't care, but it was bad enough for me being there. Mm-hmm. Now that I'm older, now that I have a family of my own, I understand where they were coming from. They must have been a bundle of nerves. So I know my mother was.
Were you wounded?
Well, I was. My hearing was affected by a mortar round. I cut my hand during a mortar attack. No, I was came close to getting shot a lot of times. Mm-hmm. Mortars nearby, but never stopped around. Remember many times being out and just hearing the rounds going over your head, just zipping by. Many occasions we knew that they were shooting directly at us, because we were either on top of a bunker and somebody would take a shot from, I don't know, 100 miles, 100 yards away, or 200 yards away, and I knew they were shooting at us because we could hear the rounds going right by us. So, I was very fortunate, very blessed in not being hit. I was always near where rounds fell, mortar rounds especially. And always near where rounds were coming by, or stray rounds. I mean, it was common, mm-hmm. everyday thing. So you get used to it. You get used to crouching. Or just learn not to make yourself a target. Because being out in the rice paddies of the jungle, the snipers can see you. so we just try not, just try to be camouflaged at all times, and try not to stand out, so that you wouldn't make yourself a target.
What was your opinion of your leadership, the American leadership? Maybe more directly in the field, did you find your tactics were successful or adequate? Did you agree with the way things were being?
Well, I wasn't in a position to disagree.
Okay.
But the one thing that we did agree on as soldiers was that there was no goal, there was no end to that. And of course, later on, we find out that that's where we failed in having a direct mission of winning the war. We were just trying to comply with Kennedy's policy, and then Johnson, and then Nixon. That's all we were doing. And of course, there's an argument that says that we were perpetuating a war by the corporations that were wanting it for there to be a war, for them to be making a profit off of ammunition and all the things that come with having a war. I don't know, but I do know that one of the things that I believed in at the time and firmly believe in right now is patriotism, my country right or wrong. I firmly believe in that. And I think that, and I know at that time that our mission was to fight communism. Communism per se still exists, but socialism doesn't. And that's what we were fighting, is the Russian style, the USSR's goal of dominating the world with socialism. We stopped it. In Vietnam. It may have taken 20 years, but we stopped it. There's no more USSR. There's no more aggression of that nature as was experienced in Vietnam, as was experienced in Afghanistan. It doesn't exist anymore. So in that regard, we did our job. It took a while, but that was the mission, as far as I remember. Mm-hmm. That was the mission, to eliminate, to fight communism. At that time, I didn't know that there was a difference between socialism and communism. So, in my mind, we were all communists. But like I said, in that sense, we did succeed, as far as that's concerned.
Did you have access to any American newspapers or military newspapers while you were in Vietnam?
Sure, they were there, but I didn't. I didn't have any interest in them. Gosh, that's a good question, because I don't remember. I think maybe a few times my parents sent me a local Avalanche Journal. Stars and Stripes, I know it was provided to us, and I know that it had to do with what was going on in Vietnam. One thing that we shared that we did keep up with, that I remember keeping up with, was the siege of Quezon, because they were under siege, and that could have happened to anybody. The only reason it didn't happen in our base camp was because we were so close to Saigon, and because of being close to Saigon, Tan Son Nhut Air Base was there, and so there was a lot of fighter bombers there. Quezon was in the middle of a valley, and it was surrounded by mountains, and so that the North Vietnamese bombing had artillery, had heavy guns. See, where I was at, we didn't have to face that. The highest, best that I recall, the highest firepower that they had using against us was the rockets and that was it. I heard some guys say that there were some tanks, that the North Vietnamese had some tanks down in Tay Ninh, but I never knew that to be true. But that was the extent of their firepower that they used against us.
you mentioned early on that while you were out in the field, sometimes when you would venture out to the surrounding villages, how much contact did you have with the Vietnamese civilian population?
I found it, for me, it was interesting because as a child, I made several trips to Mexico, and being in those villages reminded me of Mexico to an extent. I liked hanging out with them because I wasn't white and I wasn't black, so they accepted me more readily than they would accept other GIs. They were very polite, and they would share their food. And to get away from sea rations, they would go eat with them.
Mm-hmm.
But the military officers frowned on that. They didn't want us to fraternize with the civilians. Mm-hmm. We're going to the villages, especially if it was a small village where we knew that there wasn't any Viet Cong around, or that the danger was all over the place. But if we could reason that we would be okay, then we would hang out, spend some time with them, try to communicate as much as possible, and that was it. But the thing that I think that may have reduced fraternizing with the Vietnamese was the fact that they didn't want to take part in the fighting. They didn't want to. The South Vietnamese Army was the sorriest ever. I'm sure that maybe at one time they fought or wanted to fight, but I never saw. They were just hanging out, partying, and drinking beer, while we were going off to do the dirty work. So, in that sense, we despised them. So I don't remember ever establishing a close relationship with a male Vietnamese. I think the only one that I ever established a close relationship was with a guy who had been a Viet Cong and was one of our advisors, one of our scouts. That was the only one. Otherwise, I despised them simply because they didn't want to fight for their own country. I just couldn't see why not. Of course, now we know differently.
Was your unit involved in any civic action projects?
I know that the medics would go into the villages and offer minimal medical care to the villagers and the peasants. That was it. Because of the way the war was going, because we couldn't trust them, you know, they didn't care to provide anything to them. That's just the way it was. That was their fault. Because of the way they treated us. I mean, on many occasions we'd find people that worked on the base camp, we'd find them out dead in the jungle after some firefight. They were cutting our hair during the day and then trying to kill us at night, so that was hard to deal with. But other than that, I had a deep, very deep hatred of Vietnamese, and it took me a long time to get over it. And it took me a long time to even accept them as a people. And it was part of the training. Remember what I said earlier? The training was, this is how you're going to kill Charlie. And then sometime in the late 70s, I was working on a program that was after the war ended, and there were refugees were coming to the United States, and I wound up working in the program we were attending to, where some of my clients were Vietnamese. So that was hard to deal with because at one time they were trying to kill me, now and here I am trying to provide services to them. So I had a very difficult time but we became friends. So, and because they'd been in Saigon, and I was familiar with Saigon, so, and I accepted it.
Mm-hmm. What do you remember most about combat, about being out in the field?
The level of excitement. Sure, it was frightening, but it was exciting. It was very, very exciting. It's not the epitome of being somewhere, especially if you get out of life. Mm-hmm. Because there was so many, there is no set pattern to combat. There is no set time, there is no set predictable outcome. Plus, the nature of the war, the style of the war, guerrilla warfare, we had superior firepower, they had their oftentimes ancient and obsolete weapons. So we had them outgunned. So that in my role as a soldier, it was more as being right in the middle and just watching the war, watching fighter bombers come in and drop bombs, helicopters coming in and just blowing up the villages and artillery and gunship, those Air Force gunships, they called them Snoopy. They had many guns on them. They would come in the night with the B-52 bombings. We had a lot of that where I was at. So whenever large groups of Viet Cong would get together, North Vietnamese, I knew they were there, but I never saw them. It was go all out. I mean, there was a saying, spend artillery like a millionaire. In other words, you lay out 100, 200, 300 rounds. The whole idea is to blow them away because of the frustration of not being able to see him, not being able to have some solid contact. The unit I was with was very famous for taking care of the job of wasting Viet Cong, and we were very good at it. And the Viet Cong respected our unit. We respected them also. But ours was a very difficult job because we were on the route from North Vietnam to Saigon. And in thinking about where we were at, and knowing now that we were in the middle of the North Vietnamese army, that sends chills up my spine, because we were right in the middle of it. No, we didn't know. They chose not to attack until later on. And that's when, after I had left, that's where some of the guys that I've been in contact with tell me that's what happened. It was North Vietnamese. It wasn't Viet Cong. It was North Vietnamese soldiers. So, and that was it. As far for me, it was all just Viet Cong.
Did you come in contact with any wildlife, insects or snakes? Was that ever a problem out in the field?
Anyone?
Wildlife? Any problems with snake bites, insect bites?
Not me. I saw them.
You did.
There was a lot of snakes, insects. Never got bit, but they were there. Mm-hmm. We'd see them. We knew where they were at, and we would see them. Can't be squeamish in the jungle. You have to learn to wake up with bugs crawling over you, things slithering around. So it was part of being there. But as far as I know, there were some tigers. And of course, there were monkeys all over the place. But other than that, I didn't see any. I know we shot a lot of water buffaloes. So they'd be out roaming around in the night. We didn't know. Mm-hmm. So we wound up blowing up a lot of water buffaloes, monkeys, dogs, and things like that. Mm-hmm. And, but they were there.
What about insecticides? Did your unit use insecticides?
We had bug spray. We had mosquito repellent that didn't work. That was it.
What about Agent Orange? Did you?
We'd get sprayed with that. The areas, virtually all of South Vietnam, is sprayed with Agent Orange. Do you know why they called it Agent Orange? The barrels that they were shipped in had an orange ring around it. So therefore there was an Agent Orange, Agent Blue, Agent Green. Agent Orange was the main herbicide that was sprayed in the area where I was at. One time the Department of Defense sent me a letter saying that I had been in an area where there was 22 million gallons of Agent Orange sprayed. We see the helicopters floating around, this mist, planes going around and spraying stuff. You know, we didn't think about it. So we were breathing the spray. And when we go into the jungle, you could tell that it was dead. Mm-hmm. It was defoliated. But we were never warned about it. We didn't warn. There were no precautions about being around Agent Orange. If they were spraying of us to cover, nobody ever said anything.
You mentioned a letter. When did you receive this letter from the government?
Sometime in the 70s.
So it was after your service?
After my tour. Because then the there was the military was being accused. Veterans were complaining about physical ailments and saying that it was directly related to the spraying of herbicides. So then, after a period of time, the Department of Defense started sending out letters to I know I got one, to stating that you were in this area, and in this area we sprayed so many million gallons of Agent Orange. So I know that I was there. I mean, I remember breathing that stuff and being in it when it was being sprayed. So it was the opinion of the VA right now is that if you set foot in Vietnam, you were exposed. Mm-hmm. As to the extent, it'll depend on where you were at, what you did, what you ate. Mm-hmm. And they're still hurting from that. One of the biggest problems I understand right now is that all the ordnance that was left unexploded in the jungle, that since it's been so 30 years, 25 years since the war, that whenever there's an unexploded shell that explodes, that it stirs up the chemicals in the ground, so that the effects are still being felt. And over the years, I've read articles about the medical problems that they experienced, the birth defects and things like that. So it exists. Mm-hmm. And I know I was exposed. And I'm going through the Agent Orange screening at the Veterans Administration, regular physicals and checkups. And there's been some guys that have been awarded disabilities because of their ailments. But it's very difficult to prove. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to get a pension, a disability rating out of that, because you have to be dead. So it's a terrible situation, not only for the government, but for the soldiers.
Is there anything else you would like to add about your time in country, your tours?
In country, I was just a regular soldier. No heroic adventures and just doing my job. I know of guys that did do a lot of heroic deeds and performed well in combat. But it was a time that was complicated. I'm sure it was complicated for the whole country, especially for the soldiers. And I know that sooner or later there had to be a major conflict of ideologies, and that's what happened in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And as I said earlier, the goal was to eliminate communism, and we took care of that job, socialism, as we know it. But one thing that I am interested in, and hopefully we'll be able to provide you some more data later on, because I haven't heard anything about it, is there was a place in Fortsill, Oklahoma, called the Special Processing Detachment, where processing center for guys that had been AWOL from Vietnam. And there was, as to how many, I mean, we know that there was a lot of deserters, we know that there was a lot of AWOLs, but Fort Sill, I know because I was there, that's where they had the stockade, and the stockade was full of people that were AWOL, either going to Vietnam or coming back from Vietnam. And I know that there was some, what do they call it? Remember when I was there. One time a group of GIs got together and put together an underground newspaper and called it the Fort Sill Daily Pig.
Daily Pig?
Yeah. Okay. And it was articles against the war, articles against the army. And it was put together by some guys there. By the clerks at the Special Processing Detachment, and I was involved in it because I helped staple them and I helped to distribute them. And then, as a result of that, I wound up getting transferred. But there were some guys that were convicted of subversive activity, and I've never heard anything else about it. I estimate that there was maybe 40, 50 guys involved. I know that I was singled out because I helped to distribute in downtown Watton. Mm-hmm. And I was arrested the next day by the MPs. And I was transferred out of that unit, went to another unit, and the guys, leaders, the ringleaders of the whole thing, they were transferred. One of them was convicted, some of them were busted. The whole thing was broken up, and there was never any mention made of it again.
What year was this?
69. Spring of 1969. March 1969. In Fort Sill, Oklahoma. It's called the Special Processing Detachment.
You left Vietnam in December of 68, and when you went back to California?
No.
Okay.
I wound up being in Fort Sill.
Okay, that's where you came directly after.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How were you treated when you got back to the United States? Do you recall any demonstrations, for instance, when you got off the plane your first day back, or was there?
I got back at night to Oakland, and there was no one. It was in the middle of the night, so there was nobody around. So we got processed in the middle of the night, so it was I didn't see anything, even when I came home, people were just indifferent. Of course, there was no parades, there was nothing. I was just glad to be home. But once I was here a couple of days, I noticed that, well, I remember some of my friends who I graduated from high school with said, I haven't seen you for a while. Yeah, well, I've been in the war. And then some of my friends that graduated afterwards, they were volunteering when they were being drafted to go to Nam. I didn't do anything to try and stop them or to educate them or to make them aware or to caution them about Vietnam, because they were going to go either way. And one friend of mine in particular, like when I came home, I was out partying, and I ran into him, and he told me that he was on his way to Vietnam. He said, well, good luck. I didn't say anything. And he wound up losing a leg over there. So it was just, nobody wanted to talk about it. So eventually I wound up just withdrawing and only socializing with other veterans. And eventually there was about 15 or 20 of us that would get together on occasion, because nobody else cared about the veterans or what we'd been through or what we were experiencing. As a matter of fact, there was a lot of us were having difficulties in trying to get a grasp on our role in Vietnam, especially after 1975, when the war ended and we pulled out, and technically it was a loss. So there was a lot of us that were having problems trying to make some sense out of the whole thing, so that we wound up forming a rap group at the local Veterans Administration. Something, I think at one time we had, groups of 15, 20, 30 guys that would meet weekly at the VA. And from there it grew into, I think now that what happened was that all that data that was being gathered by the Vietnam veteran that worked for the VA, he was documenting it and providing it to the leadership of the VA, to where eventually there was some need for treatment and need for vet centers, because the way that guys were having problems with drugs or alcohol, or now what we know as PTSD, that took a long time to take hold of, to be recognized, so that our getting together informally helped a lot of guys, and at the same time it helped the Veterans Administration understand that there was a need for authorized treatment of soldiers that PTSD, shell-shocked, what have you. And it's still going on. It's still going on. There's a lot of guys. After every war, there's casualties. Mm-hmm. Now there's World War II veterans that are coming out with post-traumatic stress disorder. Korean War veterans finally coming out. So there's a lot happening. But with respect to the veterans and their own PTSD, it depends on the level of combat. It depends on the level of what you did, how you did it, how you let it affect you, how determined you are to continuously be a survivor, and even now be a survivor of those memories of Vietnam, because they're not always pleasant. And it's something that won't go away. Mm-hmm. See, this is what I learned from my friend Fernando, who is now a psychologist. He said, don't even try to forget it, man. You're not going to forget it. It's there. And enjoy it. That the thing you have to enjoy is the fact that you're alive. And there's a lot of guys that are dead. Don't even try, because it's not going to work. He says, I know. I studied this thing. It's like I'm a major in psychology. Got a PhD in psychology. It's because this is something that's always going to be around. And veterans are always going to have to deal with it. So I enjoy it, and I try to do my best to let others know about it. And I wish I'd been wanting to come over here and share some more, because Dr. Reckner encouraged me and some of the board members. But I wanted to open the door so that the other guys, like my friend Terry, and you know, I'll get some more guys to start. What would be interesting, Kim, would be to see if we could get this one particular unit, unit's history, for there to be some record of it, because I can only provide a small part of it. But if you manage to get enough guys from this one unit, then there will be something to put together from what happened in this particular time. And I suppose that one of the strongest messages that comes out is that regardless of what our roles were in the war, what we may have experienced, that some of us are successful, some of us are comfortable, some of us are, or sure, we think about it, sure, we get a lump in a tear whenever we hear taps and see the flag going by and things like that. But it's important for people to know that, because it's going to happen again. In case in point, the Persian Gulf. Complete opposite. Half a million troops at one time. You start the war, you get the support of the whole country, and you win it. You take care of the job. Vietnam was completely different. It built up to half a million troops for 1968. Making the tour of duty a year was a mistake, because you're taking experienced, seasoned veterans and sending them home without any kind of deprogramming, if you will. And how can you expect to win? And so in the first place, there wasn't a goal in mind. I don't remember ever being told that the war is going to end by this day, once we take care of this, we're going to go home. I mean, it was just a day-to-day thing with very little in terms of direction from Washington. The politicians, whatever they were doing, was not for the benefit of the soldier. The career soldiers were not doing it. They were doing it for their own political reasons. So I know that there's a lot of research that has been done since then, and there's some more things that have been said and written about to clarify the mysteries of Vietnam. We're coming. I think this place is going to be a critical part of the truth about Vietnam, because there's a lot of things coming out of here by bringing all sides into discussions. It helps. And one thing I do like about Dr. Reckner's direction is that he wants more input from the soldiers, individuals. And that's part of my goal, is to get more guys to participate. There's a lot of heroes here in Lubbock, Texas. You wouldn't believe the kind of things that they went through. And my role in Vietnam was very minor. Some of the guys that I know actually wounded and got 100% disabilities from getting shot 6-7 times, or losing both legs, losing a leg. They just don't talk about it. They don't think about themselves as heroes or any kind of special person. They just hang out, collect a pension. And when I've told them about it, go to the Vietnam Center, what the hell for? Yeah. So
I wanted to ask you, go ahead, about your time in Oklahoma. Could you tell me a little bit more about the newspaper and what prompted you to be a part?
Peer pressure.
By then I knew that the war was not going well.
And since I got out alive, and public demonstrations were taking place, I was not anti-war. I was more anti-military. In other words, I had come to the conclusion that if the leadership of the military wasn't behind the soldier, then there's a rotating of troops were just going to continue, and there's not going to be an end to it. Plus, we had more sophisticated thinkers that were reasoning these things out a little bit more, had a better grasp of what was going on. I was very naive still, even after Vietnam. I was very naive. But there was these college graduates that were more aware of the politics of the war and were more determined to see an end to it. And so in places like Fort Sill, Oklahoma, it took a hold because...
This is Kim Sawyer continuing the interview with Frank Gutierrez on Disc 2. It's February 5th, 2001 at 1:05 in the afternoon, and we're in the Special Collections Library at Texas Tech. Mr. Gutierrez, could you start by talking a little bit more about some of the veterans' activities, the recognition activities that you were involved in, maybe late 70s, early 80s?
The first event at the national level that I attended with some friends of mine was the dedication of the wall, Veterans Day, 1982. It was very, at that time, veterans were just starting to be recognized, and I had returned here to campus to finish up my degree because I had dropped out in the middle 70s and didn't finish my degree, so I was back on campus, and in the fall of 82 I was in my final classes and noticed, along with some friends, that there was virtually nothing available on campus relative to the war in Vietnam. So we became concerned. And as a result of the ongoing interest in Vietnam and veterans after the war, we found out that there was going to be a dedication of the wall. Of course, we've been keeping up with the project from the very beginning, and we traveled to Washington to be there on the day of the dedication. We drove. I myself three other veterans, disabled veterans, mm-hmm. actually. They were 100% disabled from combat wounds. One of them was a paraplegic. So I made arrangements to take time off from my classes and turn in some assignments so I could go, because driving over there, it's at least no less than a week. I mean, it takes 3 days to drive to Washington. So we drove over there, and it was very exciting because it was the first time that there had ever been a national... it was the first time national attention had been directed to the Vietnam veterans. So we went, and from the very beginning you could tell that this was a major event because it was called National Salute 1. And so we checked into the hotel and started to look around. And being curious, we had arrived at Washington in the middle of the night, so we decided to go to the mall where the memorial is at and look for it. And there were some guys there, and we asked, well, where's the wall? And of course, it wasn't lit, so we almost fell into it as a result of there being no lighting. So it was a very moving occasion because this was the first time, we were the first ones to see this thing. And so we looked around with flashlights, but we couldn't actually find any names because there were some people, some volunteers there, but there were just too many people at that hour that wanted to find names, so we just left it until the next morning.
And part of the events, of course, had to do with the parade. And I'm sure you've heard that there were no parades for veterans, and veterans seem to harp on that a lot, and says to there having been no parades, and which is true. Mm-hmm. So this was the first one at the national level that had the interest of veterans, and there was several hundred thousand veterans in that place. So and of course there was reunions, and all the major infantry groups had their reunions. I went and signed up for the reunion with the 25th Infantry Division, and wound up marching with them in the parade. One of the highlights of the whole thing was meeting Master Sergeant Roy Benavides, the last Congressional Medal of Honor recipient. He was in his glory at that time, because Reagan had just bestowed that medal to him. And we ran into him there at the memorial, and being from Texas and being Mexican American, we immediately became a group. And so we hung out, and it was a very exciting experience, because he had the attention of everybody. And since he had just received the medal after a 20-year battle with the Department of Defense, or the Army, because of the time that had transpired since the actual deed, and not being able to locate the witnesses and documents, so that it had taken that long for him to get it. So he was very popular as a veteran. And like I said, there was generals and colonels and people, high-ranking officers, who would be going down the Washington streets, and they would see him, and they would stop, and they would, in the middle of the street, and they would get out of their vehicles and mm-hmm. go up to him and hug him and salute him and do an about face, mm-hmm. and they're gone. And many women would go up to him and hug him and kiss him on the cheek, and just they were overwhelmed with his presence. And that was quite exciting, because by being around him, we also the attention rubbed off on us. Mm-hmm. So that was in of course the reunion. And what makes the reunion so special at that time was because the parades that we never had, and being with the veterans of the 25th Infantry Division, and actually being in a parade down Constitution Avenue was very, very exciting, mm-hmm. to say the least. But at the same time, we could see that people actually did respect veterans, and did want to recognize veterans at the time. We were overwhelmed, because we had not seen this before. We had been ostracized and castigated all along, mm-hmm. for the political loss of the war. And it was quite moving. So we went to the parade, and it wound up at the memorial, and the whole division marched up to the memorial and saluted it. And we were dismissed, and so we hung out there for 3 days, I think, just hanging out.
Did you catch up with old friends?
Yeah, and I found out about guys that I didn't know anything about. So that was a major event in my life, because many of the guys that were there had not been in touch with anybody since the war. So we were very excited, of course, but we were also very proud of the fact that we were survivors, and we were there to honor the guys that didn't come back. That was the main thing. And I think I mentioned that at that time already, there was talk of the three soldiers statue that eventually was dedicated in Veterans Day of 1984. We also made the effort to spend the money out of our own pockets to go and to be there for that event, because it was also going to be a get-together on the national international level. And so we travel to these things, and mainly for my friends and myself, it was mainly cathartic.
Yeah. The release of.
Yes,
yeah.
Because for so long we've been wondering just what mistakes that we made that things went so wrong. And in the end, people were very much opposed to us as veterans. Not that we cared that much, but it's just that traditionally veterans are always recognized. Vietnam didn't work out, so veterans were blamed for that. But as I said, being with around in the middle or part of a reunion of several thousand, if not hundreds of thousands of veterans is one of the greatest feelings that there is, because we all took part in something that was that we believed in, and we all took part as a result of our belief in the country and duty and honor and all those good things. We believed in it. It took a long time in coming, but we eventually got the recognition that needed to be bestowed upon the veterans. After the 84 dedication of the Three Soldiers statue, by then there was already a discussion of the fact that New York City was having a ticker tape parade, and that happened in May of 1985. And we traveled over there and we drove.
To New York City.
We rented a van and we said, we're going to go. And saved our money for a while. We just rented a van and just went. And of course, we stopped in Washington, and there was a lot of guys that were there, and they were also going to New York City. So we drove to New York City, and we checked into the reunion hotel, and I mean, it was probably, well, along the level of a national event, it was very significant because it was New York City. In past, Veterans Parade had been for after World War One, World War Two. I don't think Korean veterans got it. I know the Persian Gulf people did, but this was something that is special for New York City, because you march from the parade. Staging area was at Battery Park in Brooklyn. So units were marching across the Brooklyn Bridge into Manhattan, into what they call the Canyon of Heroes. So it was very exciting because there was confetti and trash being thrown from windows, and there was piles of confetti and different streamers and paper just they had already thrown from the guys that had been in front of us. It was estimated that there was almost 1 million veterans in the parade, and of course along the sides there were several thousands, if not millions, of people. But it was an experience because this was New York City.
Now, did you march in this one?
Yes. Let me see. I think I was with my with the state. I think it was the state, of Texas, because we all stuck together. Let me think, but I think that we did march in it, and no, we did go with the state because my friends were with me, and we went through that to Manhattan, and New York City was dedicating its memorial there in Manhattan at Cadman Plaza. They have a memorial. It's they call it Living Memorial. Where it's inscribed with the actual content of letters that were exchanged between veterans and family members back here. And it's situated there in Cadman Plaza, to where the the buildings or the, you can see the skyline of Brooklyn. Yeah. And it was packed, and it was a fireworks demonstration, and it was a party. It was a party. Then I think a year after the New York event, in June of 86, we went to Chicago, where they had also a reunion and events for veterans there, and that was also very exciting because equal number of veterans that had not experienced, they hadn't been to Washington or New York, and were from the Midwest, so Chicago was their event, and it was also a very moving experience because of the quality and the content of the parade, and the people in general were very, very patriotic and very recognizing the veterans in the parade. So that was also an event. I did manage to take a good group of photographs and slides that I still have. After the 86 event, Houston had a event in Memorial Day of 1987. And my understanding is that they have them every year, but this one was a what they call the Great Texas Stand Down and Reunion in Houston, and it was a good party. It's a good event because we hung around with more Texas veterans. And, there was concerts, there was reunions, and it was a great event. And we also ran into Sergeant Benavides again, so he was the parade marshal, and so they had him up there on the pedestal, so we got to visit with him again. As a matter of fact, he'd been on the Tech campus several times.
Oh, yeah.
He died 2 years ago. He was on campus the first time, I think, in the early 80s. We had invited him to come in to speak at a veterans function, and he came in and brought him to campus. I believe that the president of the university at the time was Lauro Cavazos, and so we arranged a meeting between the president of the university and Sergeant Benavides, and he also spoke to the ROTC classes. I mean, they were bananas when he saw him. Because I presume that because of their military history and then the Medal of Honor recipients and him being the last one and him being there, to them it was an honor. And they recognized him, and he gave him a speech. He also gave a speech at the Rotary Club that we took him to. Overall, Los Angeles had an event, I think it was 1988. They also had an event in LA. And we drove over there and spent about 3 or 4 days there. And I suppose that the reason we go to these places is to party as veterans. And there's no, all the veterans go because there has been plenty of tears shed, there's been plenty of sorrow, there's been plenty of tragedy that has happened with veterans, so that these events are more for enjoying than for grieving. I mean, sure, guys get to reminiscing and remembering the guys that killed over there, but for the most part, we all benefit from it because we were together and we can, it's an outlet, and we can see that there's other veterans that have also experienced some of the same things and are still experiencing them. And as far as the memories of Vietnam or the the fact that we hold it dear in our hearts, it just won't go away. It's not going to go away. And being that there's places like the Vietnam Archives now, it links up all of these different things. And it's important because we get different historical aspects of the war itself, the veterans and post-Vietnam and veterans experienced after Vietnam. That was the last time I was at a national event, as far as veterans are concerned. No, I lie. When the statue of the women's statue was dedicated in 1993, Joe Galindo and myself, we flew over there because there was only two of us. So we flew over to Washington to be there for the Vietnam Women's Memorial Project, and of course, Glenna Goodacre was the designer of that memorial. And she was a woman of the hour in Washington, and thousands of ladies that were there. I mean, it was a good event. They kept looking for guys that they patched up to Vietnam. Oh. That was the interesting thing because. Okay. They had not, many of them had not been in a national event since the war. So for them it was an opportunity to come out, so come out of the closet, so to speak, because there had never been a national effort. So they had their parade and they had their parties and reunions. And my friend Joe, being a paraplegic, he was always being stopped. Where did you get one? Where did you get medevaced? When did you get stateside? Which hospital were you at? So then these were the nurses, women that had served as nurses, that were asking these questions. As a matter of fact, they did come across some guy that they treated. So it was quite moving because they had assumed that these guys had died, and he started describing. Or relating information that only they would know, so they found each other again. So it was quite moving. And the parade was special because the saying at the time was "Welcome home, ladies." So they were there, thousands of them. I don't know exactly how many, but there was a lot of them. So when they had their parties, they had one party called the From the Delta to the DMZ, rock and roll from the 60s. I mean, it's
a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. A lot of fun.
Yeah.
And that was the last time I went to a national event. Of course, locally, I belong to veterans groups, the American GI Forum, the BFW, and I've taken part in some of the events here at the Vietnam Archives. I've gotten to know Dr. Reckner, and I know several of the board members. And one of the main reasons that I'm involved and I want to participate more is because of the lack of veterans participation. Many veterans, I don't know how many veterans you've talked to, but some veterans just don't care to let anybody know. Mm-hmm. What they experienced, and I don't blame them, but they're there, and I've got some friends that are little by little, and feel sure that they'll be contacting you, or I'll give you names so that you can contact them, and I've told them, I've asked them that they need to, because everything else is there. We've even been at the same table with our former enemies, so we need to get the veterans to start contributing and putting their stories in there, because there are some hellacious stories that local veterans have that need to be a part of this center. So I've been doing that, and those copies that you gave me about the project, I've been circulating, and so hopefully you'll get some calls, and they said you got to hear some of the things these guys say. So they just don't care. And say, what the hell you want to talk to me about? I say, what do I know? I say, look, wait, hold on.
Yeah.
You know a lot, and you've experienced a lot, and people need to know what you went through and what you feel now. And that's important because their attitude, it's not a bad attitude, a lot of it is survivor's guilt, a lot of it is just downright mad because of the turnout. Well, not necessarily mad, but very much aware of their own Vietnam and the importance, the historical importance of Vietnam as far as U.S. history is concerned. And they're especially tolerant of draft dodgers and the Clinton types, Jane Fonda's, you've heard about the fact that veterans just do not appreciate or want anything to do with Jane Fonda or her husband, Tom Hayden, because of his position on the war. And so there's a great dislike of those that chose not to serve or found some way to avoid military service. Which leads into my other interest is the minority veteran interest. My experience was that most of the minorities, most of the Mexican-American soldiers that I ran into that knew were in the combat units in many in Vietnam. To the best of my knowledge, let me see now, Texas had something like 2,500 killed in action total. Out of those 2,500, there was about 450 that were Mexican-American or Spanish surnamed, which is almost 25% of the total killed in action. Very inordinate. At that time, we were only something like 10%, 11% of the population. So the point is that we over-represent the casualties. We've always over-represented the casualties in high numbers. And part of it is because of the loyalty that we have for this country and the patriotism that we hold. And the things that good things that have transpired as a result of military service. And the main thing that I can point out that veterans were essentially responsible for was the civil rights movement in Texas that was initiated by the American Jim Crow movement in 1949. At that time, the veterans were coming home from the war and were looking for opportunities to become mainstream citizens. And they encountered barriers or biases based on race or some other bias. But the main thing that the event that caused the American Giant Forum to come forth was that there was a World War II KIA by the name of Felix Longoria who was denied burial in a Anglo cemetery, I believe in Three Rivers, Texas. Well, there was a doctor by the name of Hector Garcia who had been a medical officer during World War II, lived in Corpus Christi, and took issue with the fact that Father Longoria was denied burial in the cemetery. As a result of that event, it caused for him to reach out to other veterans just to organize and to approach the lack of opportunities for Hispanic veterans, and they did a magnificent job of taking issue with several things in the 50s and the 60s that brought us to this present situation that we have the Voting Rights Act that was implemented in 1964, and along the way they've always been a part of the civil rights mm-hmm. veterans movement. Had it not been for them, we wouldn't, as a group, we wouldn't have the numbers of elected officials, especially down in South Texas and in the Valley, veterans that actually participated in different wars that have become elected officials that continue mm-hmm. to promote patriotism and service of minorities. The black experience is something that is very vague. I don't know if you noticed that. It's very vague as far as determining exactly how many blacks participated, determining exactly how many were killed in action. Mm-hmm. It's always been a mystery because other than having their actual personnel files, there's nothing that indicates race. With Hispanics, it's less difficult because of the name.
Okay.
You can distinguish between Puerto Rican Hispanics as opposed to Mexicans or Texas Hispanics mm-hmm. because of the name.
Mm-hmm.
Puerto Rican names are usually hyphenated, and they also have a lot of Anglo names within the Puerto Rican community, so they're easier to distinguish. Plus, there was a lot of black Puerto Ricans, so that's something that's very vague. Hopefully, at some point, the archives can have some input on that because there was a lot of blacks and so on.
I wanted to ask you when you spoke about all the different events that you went to in the early 80s and on up. What do you think changed as far in American society? Why were Vietnam veterans all of a sudden getting more recognition that they didn't have as soon as the war was over? In your opinion, what do you think?
Well, because we wouldn't go away. I mean, they trained us. They trained us to be patriotic. They trained us to expect these things from our nation and our leaders. And we held them accountable.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. If the veterans, for example, had not protested, if the Vietnam veterans against the war had not united and taken to the streets in Washington, D.C., that war would have gone on for more years. But it wasn't that veterans didn't want to go to Vietnam or didn't want to take care of their job. It's just that we lacked in leadership. And we had too many rules and too much red tape involved in getting the job done. So I think that veterans are directly responsible for having put a stop to that war, because it came to a point where we just said, that's it. And then, let me see that. The lack of recognition caused a lot of veterans to be even more rebellious, and caused them to be even more become indifferent to what was happening in society, or be associated with anything that had to do with its political process, local community events and things like that. And I think that well, I know for sure locally, the emotions were triggered off when 1980, when was it that the Iranian hostages were returned? Reagan had just beat Carter. This is 1978. They've been held prisoners in Iran, in Tehran, for more than a year. And then they were released. I think Reagan was the president. The hostages were coming back and they got a parade.
Mm-hmm.
lot of veterans got mad because they said they got caught, and they're getting recognition because they got caught, and because simply because they're because veterans, Vietnam veterans, didn't get any recognition, so they were somewhat upset because of that. So locally, actually, we had a demonstration at the federal building.
Vietnam veterans,
yeah. And whenever that happened, it was 82. We had a demonstration because of the lack of recognition of veterans by the U.S. government. And at that time, we were trying to establish more services for veterans. And, we had to initiate letter-writing campaigns and with the different veterans organizations in order to get a vet center, for example, over on 34th Street. And in order to extend the social services that were being made available through the local VA. So the veterans here, as a result of the veterans coming together and demanding and requesting these services, eventually we had different departments mm-hmm. established to handle the veterans. That's when post-traumatic stress disorder started coming into the picture, after it was officially recognized as a awardable pension related to combat. So good things started coming up, and it was directly as a result of veterans taking issue and becoming elected to political office, becoming elected to the higher ranking positions of veterans organizations like the VFW, the DAV, American Legion. So I think in a nutshell, veterans just got tired of all the negative aspects of Vietnam. They just said, look, we've got to have some closure.
Mm-hmm.
And so raised money for the memorial. It was a private venture. And all the memorials have been private ventures. So, but one thing for sure, Kim, is the veterans are, they may not show how much they care, or they may be indifferent. But I know that from what I've seen and have experienced, veterans are some, Vietnam veterans especially, are some of the most loyal, dedicated, brotherhood. It's a brotherhood. There's no question about it. I mean, sure, there's been other wars, but Vietnam is just different because of the way it panned out, because of the political defeat. And it makes it, having been a part of it, makes it just a different kind of place in history. And from where I've been, I don't think the veterans, it's not so much the parades per se, but it's more the fact that, yes, we have come home and we have been accepted and we are a part of this, of the military history of this country. And it wasn't our fault that the war turned out like that. The generals themselves, I've heard them taking responsibility for things that they failed to do and things that they did to us
mm-hmm.
that they should have thought about. For example, the spraying of Agent Orange and not telling us about it. And from what I've read, generals already knew that there were, that it was a carcinogen, and they deliberately
mm-hmm.
sprayed veterans. So how do you expect veterans to feel after having gone through that? The military machine almost falls apart. Leadership is very is lacking. And morale was very, at some points, low because of the nature of war and the way it was being prosecuted. Being in the middle of it, I mean, it was frustrating not to be able to take some action, and like they did in the Persian Gulf, where you had Vietnam, you had half a million by 1968. It took 10 years to build it up to that number. Persian Gulf, it took 5 months to get half a million troops. They just bombed the hell out of the country and the war's over.
Do you think that any of those decisions were based on things that had been done in the past in Vietnam? Maybe lessons learned?
No. Plus there were some Vietnam veterans that were in charge of that war, like Schwarzkopf and Colin Powell. They weren't about to do the same thing as they had been done in Vietnam as far as sending soldiers in there and without a specific goal in mind and without the support of the people. So that was the beauty of the Persian Gulf War, that the whole country was behind it. So that in the people that were assigned to prosecute it, like Colin Powell, they were combat veterans, and they knew exactly what they had to do. And one thing for sure is that they knew that they had access to the firepower that was necessary in order to be able to put a stop to the threat of Saddam Hussein and his forces. Mm-hmm. And they didn't finish the job, or they didn't get rid of Hussein. So, but then they'll have to live with that. And I think that was the history of Vietnam, and nobody wants to repeat it. Nobody wants to, well, for veterans, of course, we have to accept the fact that it was a political loss, the only war that this country ever lost. Politically, militarily, we know that just, what is it, 90-95% of the battles that we won, casualties inflicted and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that this country changed to where, well, on this campus, we found it necessary to have a demonstration. And several years later, a friend of mine who was teaching history here invited me to speak to her class in Vietnam. And so I showed some slides and made a presentation. And as a matter of fact, I did about 3 or 4 student groups. And one time I spoke to a history class, a monster class, and we got a standing ovation from the things that we shared.
What time period was this?
About 80, let's see, yes, the late 80s.
Okay.
Because Yolanda, her name, Yolanda Garcia. We've known each other since we were kids.
Mm-hmm.
She came to Tech and got a PhD in history. Is teaching in the Dallas area.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it was, for me, it was a lot of fun to be able to share some thoughts. And but I was quite surprised when I stood up and gave us a standing ovation. It was in myself and two of the guys and spoke. They got up and gave us a standing ovation. I said, "God, this is great."
Thanks.
It makes you feel good because you've done something worthwhile. And they appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
That's when moments like that is when the loss of the war, whatever personal sacrifices we went through, were worth it. Because if we can come into our classroom and share that with kids and come away feeling good, and they go away with having learned something, that's worth it. So in that sense, that's why we do these things, to learn. And that picks up, you help to eliminate that void that's often found because of the lack of veteran participation, the lack of personal histories from veterans that is necessary in order to make this whole thing complete. I mean, you have the generals, you have the admirals, you have the academia, the academics involved, the politicians and all that. But in any war, I suppose, it's not the job isn't done until the infantry goes in and sweeps up and cleans up and takes names. In any war, and I think that's what's happening with the Vietnam War. It's all the elements are coming together. Veterans, and I think they will be sharing more of their feelings and their thoughts. It's hard for them, mind you. It's very difficult, especially when dealing with the ones that didn't make it back. But remembering the different sacrifices and what others did, and what we did collectively, we have to accept the fact, because that's what it means when you raise your right hand and you swear or affirm that you're going to uphold the Constitution of this state, of these United States. That's what that means. Win or lose, right or wrong, my country, right or wrong, that's what that means. Got a kick out of Persian Gulf Reserve guys that were complaining because they had to leave school in order to go and further commitment in the Persian Gulf. Yeah, man. And that's what you paid for.
Bye.
So that was a lot of fun because there was nothing you could do. You had to go.
Yeah.
But it ended quickly, and I think one of the reasons was because the ranks of soldiers were filled with people, soldiers, men and women from all levels of society.
Mm-hmm.
Every kind of background in America was represented. So that it seems to me that in order to avoid the possible turmoil in America, it was decided to put an early end, because you can just imagine, if we only lost 58,000 in Vietnam, Persian Gulf, the possibility of there having been high numbers of casualties was there, and that was everybody's worry, the high number of casualties. Fortunately, we got out with less than 500, something like 440 killed in action. So, and I think that part of it was because we had all elements of society involved, as opposed to Vietnam War. It was class. Blacks and browns, poor whites from Kentucky and the South were doing the fighting, and while others were getting deferments and going to school and figuring ways of staying out of the war. There was a lot of that. But I don't hold it against any guy that found a way to avoid service. I can agree that it was hard times. I can agree that maybe this was their way of handling it, just to run away from it, avoid it altogether. But there was a lot of guys that paid the supreme sacrifice. I think that for everybody, necessary to point that out for everybody, regardless. Because how can, for example, as a veteran, how can I be overcritical of those that didn't serve if what we're doing here is for everybody? And when it comes to the classification of being an American citizen, there's nothing, we're all equal, regardless. Sure, there are some problems. Sure, we have some long-range solutions that are in the picture, but at the same time, this is what it's all about to be in this country. This is having been in Washington. I don't know, have you ever been to Washington?
A long time ago.
Okay. Having been in Washington with hundreds of thousands of veterans at one time, is that's what it's all about. Mm-hmm. And that's where everything else is insignificant. That's what it's all about. And as long as that happens, then we would have done some good. And as a minority, I have to wave the flag because there are some people that can't accept the fact that they can't accept allowing others equal access to everything that this country has come from. Some people have a problem with that, and it's their problem. So that being patriotic and insisting on voting rights, civil rights, what have you, veterans' rights, and waving the flag, you get a lot more done. It's just by simply stand having that flag and standing under it. And somebody asks, well, why are you doing this? Well, this is it, right here. Need I say more? So that's why the movement of veterans after World War II, the movement of Hispanic veterans after World War II is very important, because men were paying the ultimate sacrifice on the battlefields of Europe and in the Pacific. And afterwards, they started thinking, we're a part of this. We paid our dues and we want a part of this. And gave rise to the GI Bill, housing, all kinds of good things that everybody should have. So, as far as being a veteran, being a Vietnam veteran, I wouldn't have it any other way. I think there was a question in your questionnaire, would you do it again? Yeah, do it differently. And if I could keep somebody else from having to go through the experience, definitely. I think most veterans would do it again, but would do it differently. Mm-hmm. See, that's the main
thing.
Yes, we would, but...
But...
Under different rules. Mm-hmm. And that's the main thing, because I know in talking with different veterans, that, and I agree with them, that it just wasn't approached right. It just was not. There's the argument about the corporate America wanting to prolong the war, or needing a war in order to stimulate the economy. I mean, there's some validity to that. Bankers have been known to encourage military intervention in places like Nicaragua, for example, when they sent the Marine Corps in there to stabilize the country, because Standard Fruit Company needed to have a secure area so they could bring bananas to the United States, so they sent the Marines in. So there's so many different things, but I think the beauty of Vietnam, if there is such a thing, is the fact that people learned and will continue to learn and will not allow themselves to get into this mess like that. It was a mess. It was definitely a mess. And not only for America, but for the veterans. It's still going on. This place right here, it still goes on. So there's a lot to come, I think. So, what else we need to talk about?
I just wanted to ask you, did you find that other Hispanics that you served with, they mostly volunteer? You were talking about patriotism and being instilled as a value in families. Did you come across that?
For any Latino culture, you have this machismo thing about being in the military. And I suppose it's part of anybody's culture, but for a Latino culture, it's especially important. It's especially important here in this country, because it's probably your only opportunity to let this country know that some of them may not welcome us as readily as others would, but by the mere fact that we have served this country allows us or we've earned the right, let's put it that way, we've earned the right to pursue these different things. We've earned the right to feel this way. And it's important for young people within the minority community to realize this, because were it not for the veterans, then we would not have been able to have a successful outcome for things like voting rights, things like civil rights. It would have been a little bit more difficult. But being that we were actually in the trenches, actually in combat, actually upholding the beliefs of this country, gives us even more standing, if you will, to be a part of this country. And the veterans, in that sense, veterans are extremely important. Now, if we could just harness all that energy, we'd have a much better time at it. But veterans are so opinionated. You get a group of 5-10 veterans, you're going to have a fight. And you're going to have some disagreements. You're going to have some... That's the beauty of this whole thing. That's just the way it is. But on the other hand, I remember we were in a hotel, I think it was in New York City or Washington, I don't know. No, I think it was Washington, because the Donut Dollies, mm-hmm. You remember?
Yeah.
Red Cross Blues had just started coming out, and there was some present. God, it was great, because you remember them from another time and what they did, mm-hmm. And it was just having them around that was so special. But one of them said, she said, she was right in the middle of a bunch of veterans, and she said, I feel so safe. See, what do you mean? I feel so safe. With all these guys, all these heroes, all these guys that protected us, all these guys and what they did, I feel so safe. So, yeah, I suppose you should. And there was a comment. Comments like that are extremely important because, well, one, for example, that I experienced in Washington in 1982, where there was dedication of the wall, where Washington was at its best, meaning law enforcement, personnel, everybody was at their best, welcoming the Vietnam mm-hmm. veterans. And veterans were also at their best, because this was something we never had before. But I heard some comments about being right there in front of the Capitol, because years before, veterans in protesting had thrown their medals across the fence at the White House and just dumped them.
Mm-hmm.
But I overheard some guys that said that there's enough of us here that if we really wanted to, we could take this Capitol. And it was a chilling thought, because it was so true. But that's not what it's all about for veterans, and not taking over the country, no. Even though there was enough in there, believe me, there was enough. There would have been but it's like King of the Hill. You take the hill, you take the capital, and you're it. It's just the way it would have been a coup d'etat. And it was a conversation about that. We could take this place right now. We could take it just by doing what they taught us what to do. We could take this place. But it was just a thought.
I wanted to back up a little bit. You mentioned you were a student at Texas Tech in 1970, is that correct?
Yes, 71, 72.
I just wanted to learn more about the anti-war protests here on campus. What was the political climate during this time as far as students? And
Tech had no political climate, okay. As far as I know, because it was very conservative, very apathetic, let's put it that way. But that doesn't mean that people didn't have anti-war feelings. To the best of my knowledge, I don't recall that the students themselves actually
had an anti-war protest march. I don't recall. I do know that it was some outside elements, non-students and students and minority students, that organized the anti-war march that we held here. As far as I remember, there was only one. But
were you present?
Yeah.
Was it on campus?
Yes.
Did you describe it? Do you remember where it started?
I believe it started down Broadway and came up Broadway to Memorial Circle and had a gathering in Memorial Circle. And with banners and flags, of course, and Stop the War, Stop the Killing, and things like that. Mm-hmm. That was mainly it. But, and I think it's because Tech is mainly it's a conservative campus. You're not going to get that.
Mm-hmm.
It still is.
Yeah.
Which is good. But it was critical at the time because other campuses were experiencing some extreme violence,
mm-hmm.
and some very chaotic events that took place in the more, I suppose, liberal campuses. I don't know if you call it that, but here at Tech, it was very subdued. Veterans that had served early 60s, middle 60s, late 60s, had blended into the student population, and they just wanted to get a degree and get out. And I know because I was one of them. And guys, I remember some guys that were students that graduated, that were drafted when they graduated. There was one that was cool. I'm hoping we'll call you and schedule him, or I'll give you his name and you can call him. But he graduated. He attended South Plains. He grew up in Levelland, went to South Plains College. Then he transferred to Tech, graduated in 1968, got drafted, and went to NOM. Let me give you his name. His name is Eliseo, E-L-I-S-E-O, Solis, S-O-L-I-S, 747-0151. Matter of fact, I saw him earlier before I came over here and told him that I was coming, that I was going to give him a name, because he also has an interesting situation. The anti-war, very subdued, and it was, now that I recall, it was mainly minority students that were taking part in this thing, because it was mainly minorities in the filling ranks of the combat arms. And so the more sophisticated students, the ones that were paying attention to what was coming out, were deducing that, hey, we're paying a heavy price for this war, and we need to get the hell out. That was the reason that the minority students were in uproar. I remember my friends being so opposed to the war, but I just didn't care. Just so glad to be out of the war, going to school, that it just didn't faze me that they felt so strongly about it. I think I mentioned earlier that we would read about the protesting, the demonstrations going on over here, and then over there, we just read about it, and would say things like, well, let them come over here and protest and see what they do. It wasn't going to happen. I mean, didn't care. And I think that's still the attitude of some veterans. They care about the fact that they serve, they care about the country, but they don't necessarily care about talking about it or taking steps to be able to assure themselves that at some point they have an opportunity to make it part of this place. That's the challenge for the archives, I believe, is the linking up the war with the veterans more so.
know that the board of directors has some good representation. And I know that they're always encouraging veterans to come in, but it just, I don't know, this campus scares them, or just the whole thing, not that it turns them off, it's just that it's difficult for them to get a grasp of the fact that historically it's important. I've heard some veterans comment that, well, why didn't they care then? Why didn't they do it when they were younger, mm-hmm. coming back, and things were different? Mm-hmm. So that's the controversy. Controversy goes on.
Well, was there anything else you wanted to add about any of your experience?
No, I'll think some more stuff later.
Okay.
I wanted to get more into the political. Political effects of Vietnam on the country. Save that for later. I do want to spend some time in bringing in those notices,
okay.
flyers, and different things that I kept. Feel free to call me, Kim.
Okay. This concludes the interview with Frank Gutierrez. Thank you.
Thank you.